The monk listened very carefully to me.
"Therese," he then said to me, "don't flare up as you usually do as soon as your accursed prejudices are infringed. You can see where they have led you, and you must now readily acknowledge that it is 100 times better to be a happy rogue than a well-behaved wretch. Your situation is as bad as it can be, dear girl. There is no point in disguising it from you. This Dubois you've told me about, having the greatest interest in your downfall, will most certainly be working secretly to achieve it. The Bertrand woman will pursue her own interests. All appearances are against you, and nowadays appearance is all that is needed for a death sentence. So, you're doomed. That's obvious. There is only one course of action that can save you. I have the ear of the bailiff, and he has much influence over the judges of this town. I shall tell him that you are my niece, and claim custody of you on this basis, and he will annul the entire proceedings against you. I will ask that you be sent back to my family. I will have you carried off, but this will be in order to shut you away in our monastery from which you will not get out alive. And once there, I won't hide it from you, Therese. You will be the slave of my whims and will satisfy them all without a moment's thought. You will indulge those of my fellow monks in the same way. In short, you will be the most submissive of all my victims. Do you hear? It's a harsh prospect. You know what the passions of libertines of our sort are like. Make up your mind, then, and don't keep me waiting for your answer."
"Oh, no, father," I replied in horror. "Oh, no, you're a monster to dare take such cruel advantage of my situation, to place me between death and infamy. I shall die if I must, but at least I shall do so without remorse."
"As you wish," this cruel man said to me, making to leave. "I have never tried to force people to be happy. Virtue has worked so well for you up to now, Therese, that you are right to worship at its altars. Farewell, and never take it into your head to ask for me again."
He was on his way out when some instinct stronger than me made me throw myself at his feet once more. "Tiger!" I cried in tears. "Open up your heart of stone to my dreadful setbacks, and don't impose conditions for putting an end to them that are more frightful to me than death." The violence of my gestures had disturbed the veils that covered my bosom. It was naked, bathed in my tears, my dishevelled hair falling upon it. This arouses the rude man's desires, desires that he instantly wishes to satisfy. He dares to show me just how much he is excited by the state I am in. He dares to think of pleasure when I am chained up beneath the blade that is about to strike me. I am on my knees. He pushes me over and jumps on me, with just the straw for my bed. I want to cry out, but in a rage he stuffs a handkerchief into my mouth. He ties my arms together. Now, having complete control of me, the vile man inspects me all over. Everything falls prey to his gaze, his touching, and his perfidious caresses. Finally, he satisfies his desires.
"Listen,"
he says to me, as he unties me and adjusts his clothing.
"If you don't want me to help you out, that's up to you. I'll leave you alone. I shall neither serve nor harm you. But if you take it into your head to utter a single word about what has just happened, I shall accuse you of the most heinous crimes and immediately remove from you all means of being able to defend yourself. Think carefully before speaking out. I am regarded as your father confessor, do you hear? We are permitted to reveal all where a criminal is concerned, so listen well to what I am about to say to the keeper, or I shall immediately finish you off."
He knocks, and the jailer appears.
"Monsieur,"
the villain says to him,
"the dear girl is mistaken. She was thinking of a Father Antonin who is in Bordeaux. I do not know her in the slightest, and have never even seen her before. She asked if I would hear her confession, which I have done. I bid you both farewell. I shall always be happy to give evidence, should my ministry be considered of importance."
With these words, Antonin went out, leaving me as confused by his trickery as I was revolted by his heartlessness and his libertinism. In any event, my position was too horrible not to consider all options. I remembered Monsieur de Saint-Florent. I found it impossible to believe that this man could hold me in low esteem, in view of my behaviour towards him. I had in the past done him quite an important favour, whereas he had treated me in quite a cruel manner, so it was hard to imagine that he would refuse in such crucial circumstances, either to make up for the wrongs he had done me, or at least to acknowledge, as best he were able, how generously I had behaved towards him. He may have been blinded by the fire of passion on both of the occasions I had known him, but in this case he could not, in my view, be prevented by any such feelings from assisting me. Would he repeat the propositions he made to me on the last occasion? Would he make the horrible services he had described to me the price for the help that I was about to request from him? Well then, I would accept, and once free I would easily find a means of extricating myself from the abominable way of life to which he would have had the baseness to commit me. My head full of these thoughts, I write to him. I describe my misfortunes to him. I beg him to come and see me. But I had not thought carefully enough about the soul of this man, which I had imagined was capable of being filled with benevolence. I had not remembered his horrible maxims well enough, or else, since it was my unfortunate weakness to be drawn to judge others according to my own heart, I had wrongly supposed that this man must behave towards me as I had certainly done towards him. He arrives, and as I have asked to see him alone, he is shown into my chamber and left there. It was easy for me to see from the marks of respect he had been accorded that he was a preeminent figure in Lyon.
"What the? It's you!"
he said to me, looking at me contemptuously.
"I was deceived by the letter. I thought it came from a more honest woman than you, one that I would have served with all my heart. But what do you expect me to do for an imbecile like you? You? You're guilty of 100 crimes, each more dreadful than the previous one, and when a means of earning your living in an honest fashion is proposed to you, you obstinately reject it. No one has ever been more stupid."
"Oh, monsieur," I cried, "I am not guilty."
"What must one do to be guilty, then?"
replied this hard-hearted man in bitter tones.
"The first time in my life I see you, you're in the midst of a gang of thieves who want to kill me. Now you're in the prisons of this town, accused of 3 or 4 new crimes, and it is said bearing on your shoulders the certain brand of the old ones. If that's what you call being honest, I'd like to know what you have to do not to be."
"Heaven, monsieur," I replied, "how can you reproach me for the period of my life when I met you? Do I not rather have more reason to make you blush for those times? As you know full well, monsieur, I was forced to be part of the gang of robbers who attacked you. They wanted to take your life, and I saved you by allowing you to flee. And once we had both escaped, cruel man, what did you do to thank me for the service I had done you? Can you possibly recall what you did without horror? You tried to kill me. You beat me unconscious with terrible blows, and taking advantage of the state you put me in, you took from me what I held dearest. By an unparalleled refinement of cruelty, you stole from me the little money I possessed, as if you wanted to finish off your victim with humiliation and misery. Well, you barbarian, you have succeeded. No doubt at all. Your success is complete. You are the one that plunged me into misery. You are the one who opened up the abyss into which I have kept falling ever since that unfortunate moment. Nevertheless, I can forget everything, monsieur. Yes, all this has disappeared from my memory. I even ask your pardon for daring to reproach you for it. But how can you pretend that I am not deserving of some amends, some gratitude on your part? Oh, please do not close your heart to me when the veil of death hangs over my sad life. It is not death that I fear. It is ignominy. Save me from the horror of dying a criminal. All I require from you is this one favour. Do not refuse me. and both heaven and my heart will reward you for it one day."
I was in tears, kneeling before this ferocious man, and far from reading in his expression the effect I might have expected from my efforts to move him, all I could make out was an alteration of the muscles caused by the kind of lust that is born of cruelty. Saint Florent was seated before me, his wicked black eyes staring at me in a frightful way, and I could see his hand touching his body in a manner that proved that the effect I was inspiring in him was anything but pity. Nevertheless, he disguised this well.
"Listen," he said to me, getting to his feet. "Your case here is wholly in the hands of Monsieur de Cardeville. I do not need to tell you how important his position is. All you need to know is that your fate depends on him alone. He has been my close friend since childhood. I shall speak to him. If he agrees to certain arrangements, you will be taken from here at nightfall, so that he may see you either at his place or at mine. Such an interrogation in secret will make it much easier for him to turn everything in your favour than he could do here. If this favour can be obtained for you, defend yourself when you see him. Prove to him your innocence in a manner that persuades him. This is all I can do for you. Farewell, Thérèse. Be prepared for all eventualities, and above all, do not make me take such steps for nothing."
Saint Florent went out. Nothing could equal my perplexity. There was so little resemblance between this man's offer, the sort of man I knew he was, and his present conduct, that I still feared some trap or other. But try to understand me, madame. How could I waver in the cruel position I was in, and ought I not to waste no time in grasping any semblance of help? I therefore determined to follow those who came to take me. Should I be required to prostitute myself, I would defend myself as best I could. If it meant my death, then so be it. At least it would not be ignominious, and I would be relieved of all my suffering. The clock strikes 9. The jailer appears, and I tremble.
"Follow me," this ill-tempered guard tells me. "I am here on behalf of Monsieur de Saint-Florent and Monsieur de Cardeville. Make sure you take full advantage of the opportunity heaven is offering you. We have many here who would like to be given such a chance, and who will never get it."
Having improved my appearance as best I could, I follow the keeper, who hands me over to a couple of huge rascals whose ferocious looks greatly increase my anxiety. They say not a word to me. The coach drives on, and we arrive at a vast mansion which I soon recognize to be Saint Florent's. The apparent solitude of the whole place only serves further to increase my fears. Meanwhile, my guides take me by the arm, and we go up to the 4th floor where small rooms are located that seem to me to be as sumptuous as they are mysterious. As we advanced, all of the doors closed behind us, and in this way we reached a drawing room in which I could not see a single window. There was Saint Florent, and the man I was told was Monsieur de Cardeville, upon whom my affair depended. This large, stout person of saturnine and ferocious appearance was maybe about 50 years of age, and although he was in déshabillé, it was easy to see that he was a lawyer. His entire presence seemed cloaked with a very stern air, and he exploited this to intimidate me. It is, then, a cruel injustice of providence that crime can frighten virtue. The two men who had brought me there, and whom I was better able to make out in the light of the candles that illuminated this room, were not more than between 25 and 30 years old. The first, whom they called La Rose, was a handsome, dark-complexioned young man, built like Hercules. He appeared to me to be the elder of the two. His junior had more feminine features, the most beautiful chestnut-coloured hair, and very large black eyes. He was at least 5'6" tall, as handsome as any portrait, and with the loveliest complexion in the world. His name was Julien. As for Saint Florent, you know him already. There was as much roughness in his features as in his character, and yet he did have some attractive characteristics.
"Are all the doors locked?" said Saint Florent to Julien.
"Yes, monsieur," replied the young man. "Your people are engaged in debauchery by your orders, and the porter is the only one keeping watch and will be careful not to open up to anyone at all."
These few words enlightened me, and I trembled. But what could I have done against four men?
Take a seat over there, my friends, said Cardeville, kissing the two young men. We shall call upon you when necessary.
Thérèse, Saint-Florent then said to me, pointing to Cardeville, this is our judge. This is the man on whom your fate depends. We have discussed your affair, but it seems to me that your crimes are of such a nature as to make any accommodation quite difficult.
She has 42 witnesses against her, said Cardeville,
who was sitting on Julien's knees, kissing him on the mouth, and allowing his fingers to caress this young man in the most immodest fashion.
It has been some time since we sentenced anyone to death whose crimes were more firmly established.
My crimes are firmly established.
Established or not,
said Cardeville, getting up and with effrontery, speaking to me defiantly.
You'll be burnt pissing yourself unless out of blind obedience you are willing to resign yourself completely and instantly to all that we are going to require of you.
Yet more horrors, I cried. Oh, well, then, it will only be by yielding to infamies that innocence will be able to survive the traps laid for it by evil men.
That is the way of things, replied Saint-Florent.
The weak must give in to the desires of the strongest, or else fall victim to their wickedness. Therefore, Thérèse, it is your lot to obey.
So saying, this libertine quickly lost no time in lifting my skirts. I recoiled, pushing him away in horror. But as I did so, I fell into the arms of Cardeville, who grabbed hold of my hands, rendering me defenseless against his colleague's assaults. The ribbons of my skirts were cut, my corset, neckerchief and shirt were ripped, and in a flash I found myself exposed to the gaze of these monsters, as naked as when I arrived in the world.
"She's resisting,"
they both said as they proceeded to strip me.
"She's resisting. The whore imagines she can resist us."
And as each piece of clothing was torn off, the villains struck me a few blows. As soon as I was in the state they desired, both sat on curved armchairs which were positioned next to each other, trapping between them any unfortunate individual who was placed there, and examined me at leisure. Whilst one inspected my front, the other surveyed my behind. Then they changed places, and then changed round again. In this way, I was leered at, manhandled, and kissed for more than half an hour, during which time no lubricious episode was neglected in the course of their examination. And I realized that, as far as preliminaries were concerned, both men had more or less the same fantasies.
"Well, then," said Saint-Florent to his friend, "did I not tell you that she had a beautiful ass?" "Yes, indeed. Her behind is sublime," said the lawyer, who was kissing it then. "I have seen very few bottoms as shapely as this one. It's so firm and fresh. How is that possible, given the dissipated life she's led?"
"It's because she's never given herself willingly. I told you, this girl's adventures are truly amusing. She's only ever been taken by force."
And with this, he sticks all five fingers together into the peristyle of the Temple of Love.
"But she's been had, unfortunately. It's much too wide for me. Being accustomed to first fruits, I could never enjoy that."
Then, turning me round, he subjected my behind to the same ceremony and found it to suffer from the same disadvantage.
"Oh, well," said Cardeville, "you know the secret."
"And therefore I shall make use of it," replied Saint-Florent. "And since you have no need of this same resource, and are content with an unnatural act which, however painful it may be for a woman, makes a man's pleasure just as perfect, you will not take her until I have, I hope."
"That's fair," said Cardeville. "I shall watch you and occupy myself with those preludes that are such a sweet part of my enjoyment. I shall play the girl with Julien Le Rose, while you play the male part with Thérèse. And the one is as good as the other, I think."
"A thousand times better, without a doubt. I am so sick of women," Can you imagine that I could possibly come with those whores if it weren't for the scenes that whet both our appetites so much?
With these words, this lewd couple, having made me realize that their state required more vigorous pleasures, rose and placed me upright on a wide armchair, with my elbows resting on the back of the seat, my knees on the arms, and the whole of my behind thrust out towards them. I was no sooner in position than they removed their pants, rolled up their shirt, and so were perfectly naked below the waist except for their shoes. They displayed themselves to me in this state, walking to and fro several times in front of me, affecting to show me their asses, and assuring me that what they had was quite different from anything I could offer them. Both were indeed formed like women in that area. Count of Yiel's, especially, was pale and plump, as well as shapely and elegant. They defiled each other for a while in front of me, but without emission. There was nothing very special about Cardeville's, but Saint-Florent's was a monster, and I trembled when I thought that this was the dart that had pierced me. Oh, dear heaven, how could a man of this size need first fruits? Could such fantasies be driven by anything other than ferocity? Alas, what new weapons were about to present themselves to me? Julien and La Rose, who were no doubt aroused by all this, and had also removed their breeches, now advanced, pike in hand. Oh, madame, I had never seen anything so foul before, and however shocking my previous accounts have been, this surpassed anything I have so far described, in the same way that the imperious eagle surpasses the dove. Our two libertines quickly grabbed hold of these menacing spears. They caress them, they defile them, they put their mouths upon them, and the combat soon becomes rather serious. Saint-Florent bends over the armchair I'm in, so that the parted cheeks of my buttocks are exactly level with his mouth. He kisses them, sticking his tongue into both temples. Cardeville penetrates him, offering himself to La Rose for the latter's pleasure, whose frightening member immediately disappears into the nook presented to him, and Julien, positioned beneath Florent, seizes hold of his hips and excites him with his mouth, in rhythm with Cardeville's thrusts, while the latter, treating his friend with unparalleled roughness, does not stop until his incense has moistened this sanctuary. There was nothing to equal Cardeville's transports when this climax took hold of his senses. Abandoning himself limply to the boy that served as his husband, but forcefully pummeling the one that he was treating as his wife, this vile libertine would then utter atrocious blasphemies, together with a rattle in the throat like that of a dying man. As for Saint-Florent, he contained himself, and the scene broke up without his making any contribution to it. "Really and truly," said Cardeville to his friend, "you still give me as much pleasure as when you were only 15 years old. It's also true," he continued, turning around and kissing La Rose, "that this lovely boy knows just how to excite me. Didn't you find me rather wide today, dear angel?" "Would you believe it, Saint-Florent? It's the umpteenth time I've had it today. It really is time I came. It's up to you, dear friend," the abominable man continued, placing himself in Julien's mouth, his nose thrust into my behind, while his own was offered to Saint-Florent. "Over to you for one more go." Saint-Florent comes with Cardeville, La Rose with Saint-Florent, and the latter, after a short spell, burns the same incense with his friend as he has received. If Saint-Florent's ecstasy was more concentrated, it was no less lively, or noisy, or criminal than Cardeville's. The one screamed out every word that came into his mouth, while the other contained his climax, without its being any the less active. He selected his words, but for all that, they were only filthier and more foul. In short, rage and frenzy seemed to be the characteristics of Cardeville's delirium, while meanness and ferocity were the traits of Saint-Florent's.
"Come, Thérèse, put some life back into us," said Cardeville. "You see these extinguished torches? They need to be lit again."
While Julien set about pleasuring Cardeville and La Rose Saint-Florent, the two libertines leaned over me, alternately placing their blunted blades into my mouth. As I pumped one of them, I had to shake and defile the other with my hands, and then, with the aid of a spirit liquor that I had been given, I had to moisten both the member itself and all adjacent parts. But my role was not limited to sucking. I also had to lick around the heads with my tongue and bite them with my teeth at the same time as I squeezed them with my lips. Meanwhile, our two patients were vigorously shaken. Julien and La Rose kept changing places in order to multiply the sensations produced by the frequency of entries and exits. When two or three homages had finally flowed into these foul temples, I noticed some hardening. Although the older one of the two, Cardeville, was the first one to show signs of it. He rewarded me by slapping me on one of my breasts with his hand as hard as he could. He was quickly followed by Saint Florent. The reward for my pains was to have one of my ears nearly ripped off. They paused to recover, and soon after I was warned to prepare myself to be treated as I deserved. From the horrific language used by these libertines, I clearly saw that torments were about to rain down upon me. To implore them for mercy in the state they had just got into would only have served to inflame them all the more. They therefore placed me, naked as I was, in the middle of a circle formed by the four of them sitting around me. I was obliged to pass from one to the other, in turn, and to receive from each of them the penance it pleased him to impose on me. The youngsters were no more compassionate than the old men, but Cardeville in particular distinguished himself with a more refined brand of teasing that Saint Florent, cruel as he was, could scarcely get close to. A brief respite followed these cruel orgies, and I was allowed to breathe for a few moments. I was black and blue, but what surprised me was that they healed my wounds in less time than they had taken to inflict them, and not the least trace of them remained. The orgies recommenced. There were moments when all of their blows seemed to be just a single one, and when Saint Florent, lover and mistress, generously received what Cardeville gave only grudgingly. The next moment, though no longer active, he accommodated himself in every way, his mouth and his arse serving as altars to receive their dreadful homages. Cardeville cannot contain himself, watching so many libertine scenes. Seeing his friend already erect, he comes over and offers himself to his lusts. Saint Florent enjoys him. I sharpen the arrows and present them at the locations which they must penetrate, and my exposed buttocks serve as a visual stimulus to the excitement of some and as a target for the cruelty of others. Finally, calmed down by their need to recover, our two libertines emerge without any loss and in a state fit to frighten me more than ever.
"Come, La Rose," said Saint Florent. "Take this tramp and close her up for me."
I did not understand this expression, but experience soon cruelly taught me what it meant. La Rose seized hold of me and laid me on my back onto a stool that was no bigger than a foot in diameter. There, with no other means of support, my legs dangled on one side, my head and arms on the other. My four limbs were attached to the floor as wide apart as possible. The torturer, who is going to narrow the passages, arms himself with a long needle, at the end of which is a waxed thread, and without any regard for the blood he is going to spill, or for the pain he is about to cause me, the monster sews up the entrance to the Temple of Love, in full view of his two friends, whom this spectacle amuses. He turns me around as soon as he has finished, so that my stomach is flat on the stool, my limbs dangling, and they are tied to the floor as before. Then the indecent altar of Sodom is barricaded in the same manner. I need not describe my pain to you, madame. You can imagine it. I was close to fainting.
"That's how I need it," said Saint Florent, when I had been replaced on my back and he could see the fortress he wished to invade to be well within his reach. "As I am accustomed only to gathering first fruits, how could I derive any pleasure from this creature without this ceremony?"
Saint Florent had the most violent erection, which was being slapped to maintain it. He advances, pike in hand. To excite him all the more, Julien is pleasuring himself with Cardeville before his eyes. Saint Florent attacks me, and inflamed by the resistance he encounters, he pushes with incredible force. The threads break, and all the torments of hell cannot equal my own. The sharper my pain, the more exquisite my persecutor's pleasure appears to be. Eventually, everything yields to his efforts. I am ripped. The gleaming spear has touched the end. But Saint Florent wants to pace himself and holds himself back. They turn me around. The obstacles are the same. The cruel man studies them as he frigs himself, and his ferocious hands molest the surroundings the better to attack their target. He is in position. The natural narrowness of the passage renders the attacks much more painful, and my redoubtable conqueror has soon breached all obstacles. I am bathed in blood, but what does this matter to the victor? With two vigorous thrusts of his thighs, he has entered the sanctuary, and there the villain consummates a dreadful sacrifice, the pain of which I could not have borne for a moment longer.
"Give her to me," says Cardeville, untying me. "I shall not sew the dear girl up, but I shall place her on a camp-bed that will restore to her all the warmth and elasticity that her temperament or her virtue refuses us."
La Rose immediately gets a diagonal cross of very thorny wood out of a large cupboard. This vile libertine wants to put me on this, but how is he going to improve his cruel climax? Before tying me onto it, Cardeville himself inserts a silver ball the size of an egg into my behind, and pushes it in with the aid of pomade. It disappears. It is scarcely inside my body, than I feel it swell and start to burn me. No heed is paid to my moans, and I am brutally bound on this sharply pointed rack. Pressing himself next to me, Cardeville penetrates me. He presses my back and bottom onto the points that are supporting them. Julien similarly puts himself inside him. Forced to bear the weight of these two bodies all on my own, and having no other support but those accursed knots that are dislocating me, you can easily imagine my pains. The more I push against the bodies that are pressing down on me, the more they push me back onto the bumps that are lacerating me. Meanwhile, the terrible ball has gone far up into my bowels and is contracting, burning, and ripping them. I scream out loud. There are no words in this world that can describe what I am feeling. Meanwhile, my torturer orgasms, his mouth glued to mine, seeming to breathe in my pain in order to increase his pleasure. You cannot imagine his intoxication, but following his friend's example, feeling his strength about to go, he wants to taste everything before it abandons him. I am turned over. The ball that they forced back out of me is going to cause the same fire in my vagina as it has ignited in the place it has left. It goes in and burns its way into the depths of my womb. I am tied on my stomach onto the perfidious cross, and far more delicate parts of me are about to be abused on the bonds that hold them. Cardeville penetrates the forbidden path, perforating it, while he is similarly enjoyed. Finally, delirium overcomes my persecutor, his awful cries announcing the culmination of his crime. I am inundated. They untie me.
"Come, my friends," Cardeville says to the two young men. "Take hold of this whore and enjoy her as you wish. She's yours. We leave her to you."
The two libertines seize hold of me. While one enjoys himself from the front, the other thrusts himself into my behind. They keep changing around. I was more seriously torn by their prodigious size than I was by Saint Florent's artful barricades, and he and Cardeville enjoy the two young men while they occupy themselves with me. Saint Florent sodomizes La Rose, who treats me in the same manner, and Cardeville does likewise with Julien, who excites himself in a more decent place with me. I am the center of these abominable orgies. I am their focus and mainspring. La Rose and Julien have worshipped at my altars, while Cardeville and Saint Florent, less vigorous or more weakened, pay homage to those of my lovers alone. It is time for the last one, and I am on the point of fainting.
"My friend has hurt you, Thérèse," Julien says to me, "and I am going to make it all better."
Armed with a flask of oil, he rubs me with it a number of times, and all trace of my torturer's atrocities disappear. However, nothing alleviates my pains, which are greater than any I have ever experienced before.
"With the art we possess to make all traces of our cruelties disappear, any girl who wanted to lodge a complaint against us would be wasting her time, wouldn't she, Thérèse?" What proof could they offer to support their allegations?
Oh, said Saint-Florent, our charming Thérèse is in no position to make complaints. Given her imminent death sentence, it's prayers and not accusations that we might expect from her.
She should not think of doing either of these, replied Cardeville. If she tried to incriminate us, no one would listen to her. Given the great respect and consideration accorded to us in this town, people would pay no heed to complaints that would always get back to us, and which we would always be able to suppress. Her suffering would just be longer and more cruel as a result. Thérèse must realize that we have had fun with her for the pure and simple reason that the strong are drawn to abuse the weak. She must realize that she cannot escape her sentence, that it has to be carried out, that she will endure it, that there would be no point in revealing that she left prison tonight. No one would believe her, since the jailer is one of us and would immediately deny it. Therefore, this lovely, sweet girl, so full of the grandeur of Providence, must offer it with humility everything that she has just suffered, and everything that awaits her still. These things will be like so many expiations for the dreadful crimes that have subjected her to our laws. Pick up your clothes, Thérèse. It is not yet daylight, and the two men who brought you here will take you back to your prison. I wanted to say something. I wanted to throw myself at the feet of these ogres, either to move them to pity or to ask them to end my life. However, I am dragged off and thrown into a coach, which my two guides also jump into, locking the doors behind them. Scarcely have they done so than they are again inflamed with outrageous, unspeakable desires. "Halt her for me," says Julien to La Rose. "I must sodomize her. I have never seen a behind in which I was squeezed more deliciously. I'll do the same favour for you." The plan is carried out. I try to defend myself in vain. Julien triumphs, and it is not without terrible pain that I must suffer this fresh assault. The excessive size of the assailant, the tearing of this part of my body, the burning sensations with which that accursed ball has eaten into my intestines, all of these things contribute to make me suffer torments, renewed by La Rose as soon as his friend has finished. Before I arrived, I therefore fell victim once again to the criminal libertinism of these shameful valets, and we finally entered the prison. The jailer received us. He was alone. It was still night time, and no one saw me return. "Go to bed, Thérèse," he said to me, taking me back to my chamber. "And if you ever took it into your head to tell anyone that you have left prison tonight, remember that I would deny it, and that such a pointless accusation would not get you out of trouble." "And to think that I would regret leaving this world," I said to myself as soon as I was alone. "To think that I would fear leaving behind me a universe composed of such monsters. Oh, may the hand of God take me away from it all this very instant, in whatever way it sees fit, and I shall complain no longer. The only consolation that can be left to the wretch born among so many ferocious beasts is the hope of quitting them soon." The following day I received no news, and resolved to abandon myself to Providence, I became comatose, wishing to take no food. The day after, Cardeville came to interrogate me. I could not help trembling when I saw how cold-bloodedly this villain came to exercise justice. He, the most wicked of men, he who against all the rights of this justice which he claimed to represent, had just so cruelly abused both my innocence and my misfortune. I pleaded my cause in vain. This dishonest man was artful enough to make all my defences into crimes. When all the charges of my case were well established, according to the iniquitous judge, he had the impudence to ask me if I knew Monsieur de Saint-Florent. I replied that I did know him.
Good, said Caldeville. That's all I need to know. This Monsieur de Saint-Florent, whom you admit to knowing, also knows you very well. He has given evidence that he saw you in a gang of thieves, where you were the first to rob him of his money and pocketbook. Your comrades wished to spare his life, but you were for killing him. He nevertheless managed to flee. This same Monsieur de Saint-Florent adds that, some years later, having recognized you in Lyon, he had, at your insistence, permitted you to come to pay him a visit at his residence. Though you had given your word that you were now on your best behavior, while he was preaching to you there, urging you to continue to pursue the path of virtue, you had carried insolence and crime so far as to choose these moments of his benevolence to steal from him a watch and 100 louis which he had left on his mantelpiece. And making the most of the anger and resentment that such atrocious calumnies drove me to, Cardeville ordered the clerk of the court to write that I confessed to these accusations by my silence and my facial expressions. I hurl myself on the floor. The rafters echo with my cries. I hit my head against the tiles with the intention of seeking death more quickly, and unable to find words adequate enough to express my rage, I cry, "Villain! I commend myself to that just God who will avenge me of your crimes. He will recognize innocence and will make you repent of the shameless manner in which you abuse your authority." Caldeville rings the bell and tells the jailer to take me back to my cell in view of the fact that, troubled by my despair and my remorse, I am in no state to submit to an interrogation. And in any case, the interrogation is complete since I have confessed to all of my crimes. And the villain leaves peacefully, and he is not struck down by a thunderbolt. The case went well, driven by hatred, vengeance, and lust, and I was promptly found guilty and taken to Paris for my sentence to be confirmed. It was in the course of this fateful journey, during which, though innocent, I was treated as the worst of criminals, that my heart was finally torn apart by the bitterest and most painful reflections. "I must have been born under such a fatal star," I said to myself, "since it is impossible for me to conceive a single honest sentiment that does not instantly plunge me into an ocean of misfortunes. And how can it be that this enlightened providence, whose justice I like to admire, while punishing me for my virtues at the same time shows me those who have crushed me with their crimes at the pinnacle of success? In my childhood, a usurer tries to force me to commit a theft. I refuse, and he grows rich. I fall among a band of thieves, from whom I escape with a man whose life I save. He rewards me by raping me. I arrive at the house of a debauched lord who sets his dogs on me for not wanting to poison his aunt. From there, I go to the house of an incestuous and murderous surgeon whom I try to prevent from committing a horrible act. The torturer brands me as a criminal. He doubtless commits his crimes and makes his fortune while I am obliged to beg for my bread. I wish to take the sacraments. I wish fervently to implore the Supreme Being for help, despite his sending me so many ills, and the august tribunal, where I hope to purify myself in one of our most sacred mysteries, becomes the bloody theatre of my ignominy. The monster who abuses and defiles me is elevated to the greatest honours of his order, and I am again plunged into the dreadful abyss of misery. I try to save a woman from her husband's fury, and the cruel man tries to put me to death by causing me to lose blood, one drop at a time. I try to help a poor man, and he robs me. I assist a man who has fainted, and the ungrateful wretch makes me turn a wheel like an animal. He hangs me for his own amusement. He is favored by fate at every turn, and I am about to die on the scaffold for my forced labor at his hands. A shameless woman decides to seduce me into committing another crime, and for the second time I lose the few goods I possess when I try to prevent the theft of her victim's treasures. A sensitive man wants to make up for all my ills by offering me his hand in marriage.
and he expires in my arms before he can do so. I expose myself to danger in a fire in order to save from the flames a child that does not belong to me. The mother of this child makes an accusation and brings a criminal action against me. I fall into the hands of my most mortal enemy, who wants to take me back by force to a man whose passion it is to cut off heads. If I manage to escape this villain's sword, it is to fall under the sword of Temis. I implore a man whose life and fortune I have saved to protect me. I dare to expect some gratitude from him. He lures me into his house and subjects me to horrors. There, I am confronted with the iniquitous judge on whom my case depends. Both men abuse me. Both insult me. Both hasten my doom. Fortune showers them with favors while I face an imminent death. This is what men have done to me. This is what I have learnt from the dangers of associating with them. Is it surprising that, embittered by misfortune and revolted by outrages and injustices, I should in my heart aspire only to avoid all contact with them in the future? 1,000 excuses, madame. 1,000 pardons for having sullied your spirit with so many obscenities, for having, in short, abused your patience for so long. Perhaps I have offended against heaven with my foul tales. I have reopened my wounds, and I have disturbed your rest. Farewell, madame. Farewell. The sun is coming up. My guards are calling me. Let me go to meet my fate. I fear it no longer. It will put an end to my torments. This final moment in the life of man is terrifying only for that fortunate person whose days have been cloudless. But the wretched creature, who has breathed in nothing but the venom of vipers, whose faltering steps have walked on nothing but thorns, who has seen the light of day only as the traveller who has lost his way trembles to see lightning fork across the sky, she whose cruel setbacks have taken away parents, friends, fortune, help, and protection. She who has nothing left in the world but tribulations to eat and tears to drink. Such a girl, I say, sees death approach without fear, and even welcomes it as a safe port, where she will once again find peace in the bosom of a God too just not to allow innocence, defiled on earth, to find recompense in another world for so many woes.
The good Monsieur de Corvie had not heard this story without being profoundly moved by it. As for Madame de Lorsange, in whom, as we have said, the monstrous errors of her youth had not extinguished all sensitivity, she was on the point of fainting. "Mademoiselle," she said to Justine, "it is difficult to hear what you say without taking the keenest interest in you. But I must admit that an inexplicable feeling, one far tenderer than I can describe, irresistibly draws me to you, and makes your woes my own. You have disguised your name and concealed your origins from me, and I beg you to confess your secrets to me. Do not imagine that I am compelled to speak to you like this out of vain curiosity. Good Lord, could my suspicions be true? Oh, Thérèse, could it be that you are Justine? Could it be that you are my sister?"
"Justine! Madame, what a name!"
"She would be around your age today."
"Juliette! Can it be you?"
said the unfortunate prisoner, throwing herself into Madame de Lossange's arms.
"You! My sister! Oh, I shall die far less unhappy now that I have been able to embrace you one more time."
And the two sisters, their arms wrapped tightly around each other, could communicate only in sobs and express themselves only in tears. Monsieur de Corvie could not help weeping himself. Feeling that it is impossible not to take the greatest interest in this affair, he goes into another chamber, writes to the Chancellor, describing in vivid detail the horror of the fate of poor Justine, whom we shall continue to call Thérèse. He answers for her innocence, asking that until all can be cleared up at the trial, the accused shall have no other prison but his chateau, and undertaking to represent her when this sovereign head of justice commands it. He introduces himself to Therese's two guards, entrusting his letters to them, and accepting all responsibility for the prisoner. They agree, and Therese is entrusted to his keeping. A carriage approaches. "Come, wretched creature," says Monsieur de Corvie to Madame de Losange's fetching sister. "Come with us, and everything is going to change for you. It will not be said that your virtues have never been rewarded, and that the beautiful spirit you have received from nature has only ever encountered hearts of stone. Follow us, and your fate will henceforth depend on me alone." And Monsieur de Corvie briefly explains what he has just done. "My dear, decent man," says Madame de Losange, throwing herself at her lover's feet, "that's the finest thing you've done in your life. It is for him who truly knows the heart of man and the spirit of the law to avenge oppressed innocence. There she is, monsieur. There is your prisoner. Go, Therese, go, run immediately, and throw yourself at the feet of your just protector, who will not abandon you like the others. Oh, monsieur, if the bonds of my love for you were already dear to me, how much more will they be, strengthened by the tenderest estimation?" And these two women in turn embraced the knees of such a generous friend, bathing them with their tears. A few hours later, they arrived at the chateau. There, Monsieur de Corvie and Madame de Losange vied with each other to transport Therese from an excess of misfortune to the height of luxury. They delighted in feeding her with the most succulent dishes. They gave her the best beds to sleep in. They wanted her to be in charge in their home. In short, they invested their attentions with all the delicacy that it was possible to expect from two sensitive souls. For several days they plied her with remedies. They bathed her. They adorned her with jewels. They beautified her. She was the idol of the two lovers. It was a matter of which of the two would make her forget her woes the soonest. An excellent surgeon undertook treatment to remove that ignominious brand, the cruel fruit of Rodin's wickedness. All of Therese's ills responded well to the care and attention lavished on her by her benefactors. The traces of her misfortunes quickly disappeared from the countenance of this amiable girl, and the graces soon re-established their empire in her features. The livid hues of her cheeks of alabaster, that so much woe had made pale and gaunt, were replaced by the roses of youth. The laughter, banished from her lips for so many years, finally reappeared there, fanned by pleasure's wings. The best news had just arrived from the court. Monsieur de Corvie had set the whole of France in motion. He had inspired Monsieur S. with renewed zeal, so that the latter had joined him to describe Therese's misfortunes, and to restore to her the peace and tranquillity that was so clearly due to her. Eventually, letters arrived from the king, purging Therese of all legal actions unjustly brought against her, restoring to her the status of honest citizen, forever silencing all the tribunals of the kingdom where men had sought to defame her, and awarding her 1,000 écus pension from the gold seized in the workshops of the counterfeiters of the Dauphine. The authorities had attempted to arrest Cardoville and Saint-Florent, but following that fateful star that governed all of Therese's persecutors, one, Cardoville, before his crimes were brought to light, had just been appointed to the administration of the other to the general administration of colonial trade. Each one had already arrived at his destination, and the arrest warrants came up against powerful families who soon found the means to quieten the storm, and safe in the bosom of good fortune, the crimes of these monsters were soon forgotten. As regards Therese, as soon as she learnt of so many agreeable prospects in store for her, she almost expired with joy. For several days in a row, in the bosom of her protectors, she wept tears of happiness, when suddenly her mood changed, without its being possible to work out why. She became sombre, anxious, and dreamy, occasionally crying in the midst of her friends, without herself being able to explain the reasons for her anguish. "I was not born for so much happiness," she would say to Madame de Losange. "Oh, my dear sister, it cannot last long." They tried in vain to assure her that all her problems were over, that she need worry no longer. Nothing could calm her. One might have said that this creature, uniquely destined for misfortune, and feeling the hand of ill luck still hovering over her head, was already foreseeing the final blows that were about to crush her. Monsieur de Corvilles was still living in the countryside. Summer was almost over, and it seemed that the approach of a frightful storm might threaten a walk they had planned. The excessive heat had obliged them to leave all of the windows open. The lightning flashes, the hailstones fall, the winds hiss, the clouds are stirred by the fire of heaven, sweeping them along in a horrible manner. It seemed that nature, bored with her works, was determined to mix up all the elements to reshape them anew. A fearful Madame de Lorsange begs her sister to close up all the windows and doors as quickly as she can. Eager to calm her sister, Thérèse rushes to the windows, which are already shattering. For a few moments she struggles in vain against the wind, and then a flash of lightning throws her back into the middle of the drawing-room. Madame de Lorsange utters a piercing scream and faints. Monsieur de Corvilles calls for help. All lend a hand. Madame de Lorsange is brought round, but the unfortunate Thérèse is struck in such a manner that there can be no hope for her. The thunderbolt has entered her right breast. Having destroyed her chest and her face, it has come out through the middle of her stomach. The miserable creature was horrific to look at. Monsieur de Corvilles ordered her to be carried away. "No," said Madame de Lorsange, rising with great calm to her feet. "No. Leave her here in front of me, monsieur. I need to contemplate her, so that I may remain firm in the resolutions I have just made. Listen to me, Corvilles, and above all do not oppose the decision I have made. Nothing in this world could distract me from my intentions now. The unique misfortunes experienced by this wretched girl, despite her having always observed her duties, are too extraordinary not to open my eyes to myself. Do not imagine that I am blinded by those false rays of happiness that we have seen the villains enjoy who sullied Thérèse in the course of her adventures. Those whims of heaven are enigmas that are not ours to divine, but they should never seduce us. Oh, my friend, the prosperity of crime is but a trial that Providence wishes virtue to undergo. It is like the thunderbolt whose deceptive fires embellish the skies for an instant, merely to plunge the wretch they have dazzled into the chasms of death. The example of this lies before our eyes. The unbelievable calamities, the terrifying and repeated setbacks endured by this charming girl, are a warning from the Eternal to listen to the voice of my conscience, and at last to throw myself into his arms. What punishments must I fear from him, I whose libertinism, irreligion, and abandonment of all principles have marked every moment of my life? What am I to expect when a girl who had not one single fault to be reproached for in the whole of her life is treated like this? Let us part, Corvilles. It's time. No ties bind us. Forget me, and approve of my decision to renounce the infamies with which I have besmirched my name, and to repent of them forever at the feet of the Supreme Being. This dreadful blow was necessary for my conversion in this life, and also for the happiness I dare to hope for in the next. Farewell, monsieur. The last mark I expect of your friendship is that you will not conduct searches of any kind to discover what has happened to me. Oh, Corvilles, I shall wait for you in a better world, where your virtues must surely take you. May the mortification in which to expiate my crimes I intend to spend the unhappy years that I have left permit me to see you again there one day. Madame de Lorsange immediately leaves the house. She takes some money with her, jumps into a carriage, leaving to Monsieur de Corvilles the remainder of her property, with instructions for charitable legacies, and hastens to Paris, where she enters the Carmelite order, where, within a very few years, she becomes a shining example and lesson to all, as much by her great piety as by the wisdom of her thought and the steadfastness of her morals. Deserving to attain the highest office in his homeland, Monsieur de Corvilles was successful, and only used this honour to work in equal measure for the happiness of his people, the glory of his master, whom he served well, even though the latter was a minister, and the fortune of his friends. O you who have shed tears over the misfortunes of virtue, you who have pitied the wretched Justine, while forgiving the perhaps rather strong colours which we have felt obliged to use, may you at least derive the same benefit from it as Madame